But tonight we're going to be talking about the Bible. I may be referring to some of these things throughout this lesson, but our focus this evening is going to be found in the book of Revelation, which is actually probably my favorite New Testament book. And I believe in order to understand the message of the book of Revelation, we've got to realize that the book was first written to Christians of the first century who lived in the area of Asia Minor, and they were under Roman rule. And so you need to understand when you go to the book of Revelation that you're reading someone else's mail. As is true of other inspired letters, however, it would have a purpose beyond the specific churches that were addressed. But if you'll turn to Revelation chapter 1, Revelation chapter 1, we read to whom the message was intended in verse 4. But let's just start in verse 1. Revelation chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants, things which must shortly take place. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ and to all things that he saw. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. And then in verse 4 we read, John to the seven churches which are in Asia. And so we see right from the first that we have to look at what the message would initially have meant to them. How would they interpret the signs and the symbols which we read in verse 1 must shortly take place? And again, in verse 3, where John says, for the time is near. And if we can succeed in understanding what the message was for them in the first century, then we can make application to ourselves and to our circumstances today. Now, before we begin to go to our text, which is going to be Revelation chapter 12 here in just a little bit, I want you to put yourself in the first century Christian's shoes. Let's say that you are a Christian living in Asia Minor during this time. What would your world be like at that particular time? Well, Rome at that period in history was at the zenith of her greatness. Her boundaries extended from the British Isles to the African desert, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Euphrates River. The city of Rome, in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, in Revelation 17 verse 1, she's described as the great harlot sitting upon many waters. And those many waters that are mentioned in that verse, they're described by John as being the peoples, multitudes, and nations, and tongues. And so to you, if you were living back in the first century, it would seem that Rome was the whole world. And you would see an empire that was extremely immoral and ungodly. If you lived during the time when Revelation was written, you would hear the Roman teachers and philosophers speak great words about purity and morals. But if you looked at their lives, you would see them living a very immoral lifestyle. You would see Roman marriages that were no more than a commercial transaction, easily bought, easily discontinued or dissolved. You would be shocked if you would look at their view of their children, which were considered a burden, and so they were either left to the slaves to be reared, or their children themselves would be sold into slavery. And then there were the emperors that began to regard themselves as gods and demanded to be worshipped. It started with Julius Caesar when he had his statue placed among the gods in the Roman temples. Then later on, Augustus had temples built for himself and the goddess Roma. Nero believed that he was divine and would take his place among the gods after this life. But for Christians that were unfortunate enough to live during Domitian's reign, well, the laws enforcing emperor worship became more threatening and deadly. In fact, Domitian would become the emperor to go down in history as the one that bathed the empire in the blood of Christians. And so you would see images of Domitian that were put throughout the empire, put up for his worship. And he set up the Roman Concilia, actually, in Asia Minor, which was a governing body, that their job was to see that people worshiped Domitian. His letters, he would refuse to receive any kind of correspondence unless the letter started with "Our Lord and Supreme God." And so this is how he viewed himself. And if you were living back at that time, maybe you had lost a parent or a brother because, or a sister or our family members, because Domitian had thousands of victims sacrificed because they refused to worship him. So here you are. You're a Christian in one of these churches that are addressed in the book of Revelation. And this is what you would have been experiencing. Those of your brethren who had been captured or who refused to worship the emperors as gods, they may have had their properties or their businesses confiscated. Worse, they might have been exiled or tortured or put to death. And you're losing hope. I mean, you're at a point of despair. It seems as if ungodly and immoral Rome is going to continue to thrive and Christianity is going to be wiped out. And so you're asking how long, you're crying out to God. Are you there? Do you know what's going on? Do you know what's happening to us? Why aren't you intervening? Why aren't you stopping this madness? Similar to the question that was asked in Revelation chapter 6 and verse 10 by the martyrs that were under the altar, were asking, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell here on the earth?" And so God sends you a message, and he sends it through the pen of John. And as is the nature of this kind of literature, Revelation is a special kind of literature. That was called apocalyptic literature. And it was a special kind of way that God revealed messages to his people. He reveals his message to you through very vivid imagery and very dramatic signs and symbols. You and your brothers and your sisters, you've been experiencing horrible persecutions, and you need a strong and forceful message to basically wake you up and encourage you not to despair and to be assured that God is really aware of what's going on. And so you read in the book of Revelation of rivers of blood and hailstones that weigh 100 pounds, and a dragon so large that when he throws his tail out, he knocks a third of the stars out of the sky. You see death riding on a horse with the grave following behind. You see a woman with the sun as her dress and the moon as her footstool. You'll see animals with many heads and horns, and a dragon that casts from its mouth a river of water to destroy a woman that sprouts wings and is able to escape him. You see a dragon and a beast and a false prophet that all spit up a frog that goes out and recruits armies to gather for the evil one. Very dramatic words for dramatic times. Exaggerated symbols that were meant to make a strong impression upon you. And through these visions and these signs and these symbols that John writes about in Revelation, you begin to understand that God is telling you, yes, I am aware of what is happening. Rome will not go unpunished for these atrocities. And you begin to get a picture of a very terrible and evil power that is behind Rome's persecution of God's people. You begin to get a glimpse of your real adversary. And that brings us to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. And that's where we're going to talk a little bit this evening about our adversary as well. Revelation chapter 12. Let's start reading in verse 1. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 1. Here John writes, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars." Now, I'm not going to have a chance to fill in all of the imagery and what the numbers meant, but you can read Middle Eastern or Eastern literature and Oriental literature and come to understand that colors and numbers, they had great significance to the people of that time. And so you can go back and you can look at secular literature that will give you an idea of what these numbers and these various colors and all were used, what kind of significance they would have to people of the first century. I mean, we have things like that today. I mean, you know, in the old westerns, who wore the black hat? The bad guy always did. And our hero wore the white hat. And you know, what's, you know, when you see the number 13. Now, most people today say, so what? But no, there are some hotels still that there is not a 13th floor and there's not a 13th room. Because that to us means bad luck. I mean, we have our own signs and symbols in our culture today. Well, they did back then as well. And so you see here in verse 1, a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, a crown of 12 stars upon her head. 12 represents the people of God. And so she probably represents the faithful remnant of Israel through whom Christ was born. And the important point about this woman is, in verse 2, she's with child. She's about to give birth to a child. And she cries out in labor and in pain to give birth. And so here's this woman arrayed in light. She's crying out. The faithful are crying out, anxious to see the birth of the promised child. But there's another factor to consider. Verse 3, there's a great dragon, which we learn in verse 9, represents Satan. But another sign appeared in heaven, verse 3. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. Now, to the Christians in Asia Minor, the dragon symbol would represent one who is ferocious and powerful. He is red in color, the color of blood, emphasizing his wrath and his murderous nature. He has 7 heads, which most likely symbolize great intelligence and cunning. He has 10 horns. The horn was the symbol of power. And so he has great power. Upon his heads are 7 diadems or crowns, symbolizing great authority. So here is quite an adversary for this woman. He's cunning, intelligent, powerful, has great authority. He's murderous in his nature. And he's big. Look at verse 4. It says his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. Again, so large that with a lash of his tail, he can knock down a third of the stars from the heaven. This huge, fierce, and powerful dragon stands before the woman. He's ready to devour her child as soon as he is delivered. I mean, what chance has this woman and her newborn child against such opposition? I mean, it appears like game over. We know what's going to happen when the child is born. It's hopeless. But wait, verse 5 tells us she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And the Christians who would be familiar with Old Testament prophecies, they would know this is the Christ. He's talking about when Jesus was born here. So the woman, she's the one that gives birth to the Christ child. But what's going to happen to him? I mean, the dragon's right there. He seemingly is ready to devour the child as soon as he's born. And from the early days of Jesus' childhood, the devil did try to destroy him. And through the years of his ministry, those efforts continued. And at last, the devil appeared to be the victor when Christ was nailed on that cross and then was placed in that tomb. But Satan had no hold on him. He was resurrected from the grave. He was caught up to the very throne of God. And so the devil, basically the dragon, loses the first battle in this conflict between good and evil. And we read that her child in verse 5 was caught up to God and to his throne. Now keep in mind that again, what we're talking about is apocalyptic imagery. Dramatic words for dramatic times. The battle is raging. The scene, it shifts from the heavens to the earth and back to the heavens and back to the earth in the course of events that we're reading here. John is not trying to give his readers a little insight on the origin of Satan here. That's not what this is about. This is about the battle between good and evil. This is the devil, the dragon, the serpent, the evil one that's trying to bring down God and his forces. And so he's describing the fierce efforts of the dragon here in chapter 9 to destroy the child. And then in verse 6, after she delivers the child and the child's caught up into heaven, it says the woman, verse 6, fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And if you do the math, that's 3.5 years. And the number 3.5 to the Oriental mind symbolized an uncertain period of time with a definite ending to it. But again, there was just not sure how long this was going to last. And so the woman, she flees to a place where she's protected and cared for. Her child is caught up into heaven, but the dragon doesn't give up. He gathers his forces. And we read in verse 7 now, Revelation chapter 12, verse 7, "And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer." And so remember, where was the dragon before this happened? He was waiting for the child to be born. Again, this is not giving us insight on Satan's origin here. The dragon was up in the heavens waiting for the woman to give birth to the child. The child was born, but then the child was caught up into heaven and the woman flees. And so he says, well, I'll go and I'll make war up there. And so he gathers his forces and he goes and meets the forces of heaven. But yet they didn't prevail. There wasn't a place found for them. So Michael is the fighting angel, and the forces clash, and we see that it's no contest. In verse 9, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." I mean, he didn't get even a foothold in heaven, but he's cast down, his angels with him to the earth. Now, we're going to stop at this verse, and I want you to notice that there are four different names that are given to the evil one, and their significance in each of those words that's used to describe him. He's described as what? The great dragon, the serpent of old, the devil, and Satan. And I think it behooves us to know a little bit about our adversary as much as we can, so that we know how to resist him, so that we're familiar with the ways that he uses against us in our efforts. So let's look at that first name there that's used, the great dragon. Now, not only does this describe him as a powerful foe, but the term dragon or monster, depending on the translation that you use, it conveyed the idea of a huge, fierce beast. And this huge, scaly beast was actually used in the Old Testament as well to describe ungodly nations that persecuted God's people. If you look at the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 29 and verse 3, this term is used in Ezekiel 29 and verse 3. When it says, "Behold, I am against you, O Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon who lies in the midst of his rivers." And Egypt many times were enemies with God's people, would come in and invade God's people. At one point in time of Old Testament history, had enslaved God's people. And so he's using the term dragon to refer to Egypt. You go to Jeremiah, the 51st chapter, Jeremiah 51 and verse 34. In Jeremiah 51, verse 34, this is during the Babylonian captivity, says, "Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, has devoured me. He has crushed me. He has made me an empty vessel. He has swallowed me up like a dragon." And this was, again, a term for those that were familiar with the Old Testament. You know, when you see an ungodly government trying to crush or destroy the people of God, the Bible sometimes pictures that evil force as a dragon. And it is very true. Satan has influence over the kingdoms of this world. He can corrupt rulers and leaders to the point that they will tolerate or even promote the persecution of God's people. Isn't this happening in our country? Haven't we seen things change in the last 40 or 50 years? I mean, abortion has been legalized. Homosexual marriages are being legitimized. Pornography and all forms of ungodliness, they're being protected as free speech. School prayer has been banned. A teacher can be fired for reading their Bible in the classroom. The dragon has a lot of influence over governments and world powers. And we may see that increasing, probably will, in our day and time. We need to understand who is behind that. Who is our real adversary and enemy? So he's the dragon. He's also in that verse referred to as that serpent of old. I mean, Satan first appeared on the scene of history in the form of a certain serpent back in the Garden of Eden. And he succeeded in influencing Adam and Eve to mistrust the word of God and accept his word instead. And while the name dragon depicts the power of the evil one, the term serpent describes his cunning. And whenever the deception is used, wherever error is being spread, wherever doubt is implanted, the serpent is behind that. And it's the serpent that whispers lies in our ears. It's the serpent that sends out false prophets to deceive us. In 2 Corinthians 11:3, Paul writes, "But I fear, lest somehow as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ." You go a little bit further in that same chapter, look down at verse 14. 2 Corinthians 11:14 tells us, "And no wonder, for if Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light, therefore it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works." He loves working behind the scenes. He loves to put on the show of, "I'm giving you the truth. I'm telling you the way things really are." And it's all lies. That's why Jesus warns us of our adversary in John 8:44. When describing Satan, he says he was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. We see that today. In fact, I was reading not too long ago of a speech that was delivered on one of our university campuses where the speaker was saying, "I know that you are here in the frontline trench against powerful forces of darkness. I salute you. I sympathize with you. Fight the good fight." And although these may sound like words that Paul might have penned to Timothy, these are actually words of a speech that were delivered by British biologist, evolutionist, and atheist Richard Dawkins. I don't know if you're familiar with any of his words. He's probably in the forefront of the fight against any kind of religion and any kind of God. He was really at the University of Kansas when he was speaking about a book that he had actually written in 2006. It was a book that created quite a stir among both the scientific and religious communities. Now, some within the scientific community applauded his efforts and felt that it was high time that a scientist was once again bringing attention to the philosophical battle that's being waged. Other scientists felt that he had gone too far and was too harsh in his approach. And of course, you know, people in the religious community took exception to his words, and the name of his book was The God Delusion. And you can understand just from the title why it served as kind of a lightning rod for controversy and debate when you read his statements in this book. Statements like, "I am attacking God, all gods, anything and everything supernatural, wherever and whenever they have been or will be invented." And he's taken his campaign really into the political realm. There was a campaign that was launched in England where this and similar ads were placed on almost 1,000 buses throughout the United Kingdom in both England and Scotland. And so they were just blatantly saying, "There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." And that's the message they were giving out. And we need to be aware that atheistic groups are going to great lengths to try to influence you and your children. In fact, Dawkins goes so far as to say that religion should not be allowed to be discussed in the home if there are children. And he makes the point that teaching a child to be religious is a form of mental child abuse. And there are those who are listening to him. There are those in government agencies who are listening to him. And that's probably why in a review of his book, Publishers Weekly commented, "For a scientist who criticizes religion for its intolerance, Dawkins has written a surprisingly intolerant book, full of scorn for religion and those who believe." But he wasn't finished when he wrote The God Delusion. In fact, I have most of his books. The next one that he came out with after that was a book that he entitled The Greatest Show on Earth. And he tries to show in this particular book why you don't need God as an explanation to life and its origins. And he admits that in his previous books, The Evidence for Evolution really was nowhere explicitly set out. And this was a serious gap. And so in this book, he says, "I'm going to close the gap." And he clearly states the purpose of this book when he says in his introduction that this book is my personal summary of the evidence that the theory of evolution is actually a fact, an incontrovertible a fact as any in science. And so he says, evolution is a fact. Beyond reasonable doubt, beyond serious doubt, beyond sane, informed, intelligent doubt, beyond doubt, evolution is a fact. The evidence for evolution is at least as strong as the evidence for the Holocaust, even allowing for eyewitnesses to the Holocaust. We know this because of a rising flood of evidence which supports it. Evolution is a fact. And this book will demonstrate it. No reputable scientist disputes it, and no unbiased reader will close the book doubting it. And so I would be considered, I guess, an unreputable scientist. Because, you know, people would hear, you know, you're a biology professor? Yeah. And you're a preacher? Yeah. And they kind of go, aren't those kind of at cross purposes with themselves? Not if you stick to true science. Not if you stick to just the facts. Now, there is a philosophy, there is a belief system that is called Darwinian evolution. But I always taught my students to be able to discern between fact and philosophy and know the difference in the two. But he makes the claim that it is absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked. But I'd rather not consider that. And these are the kinds of things that your kids may come up against. Especially those who Dawkins is one of their heroes. And they may be told these kinds of things. And these can be pretty intimidating words to those who aren't used to that kind of rhetoric. And even though the science that he presents is pretty much nothing new, I must admit that in reading both of these books, I had to put them down periodically and just allow my blood pressure to go back down and my stomach to quit churning. And it wasn't because of some new brilliant argument that he had made, because there's really nothing new here. Yeah, in fact, in a review, one of his fans actually writes in a British newspaper called The Guardian, he says, the science covered is, it must be said, pretty standard stuff. The Galapagos Islands, the laryngeal nerve in mammals, wings of bats, human ape fossil links, the human genome, the development of the human embryo, they line up in what would be termed in an American university, Evolution 101. His second agenda is, as always, kidney jabs at creationists and allied trades wherever the chance arises. And that's really why I had to put the book down. I just can't understand a mindset that belittles and begrudges and degrades and bullies others in submitting to one's viewpoint. But I got through them because I believe it's important for us to at least be familiar with what the other side of any issue is saying. We need to, as Peter tells us, always be ready in 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you. And while our children might not hear words in their science classrooms as brazen and as caustic as what Richard Dawkins writes, we need to be equipping them with the intellectual and reasoning skills so that they can deal with issues that have a direct impact on whether or not they can have confidence in what Genesis 1:1 says. That in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we need to show them how to answer and how to reason through the statements that evolutionists and atheists are making, and show them really how insubstantial their claims are. Because our young people, they may be facing sarcasm and ridicule and other kinds of intimidating tactics. I mean, these are certainly used, and quite skillfully, I must admit, by Dawkins in a lot of his books. Maybe that's why one reviewer in a British newspaper, and he agrees with Dawkins, but he said if Thomas Huxley, and Thomas Huxley was one who really promoted Darwin's ideas at the beginning of the 20th century, if Thomas Huxley was famously Darwin's bulldog, then Richard Dawkins is probably best described as Darwin's pit bull. Well, our kids need to know how to handle the pit bulls that they may encounter in education. But why? you know, why do the more prominent evolutionists and atheists, why do they make such extreme statements? I mean, isn't the air of our culture right now one of tolerance? Just live and let live and let everybody believe whatever they want to believe. Why so intolerant? I mean, why so reactionary against the idea that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth? Well, I think geneticists Richard Lewontin of Harvard, in his review of Carl Sagan's book, Billions and Billions, he admitted that evolutionists have a prior commitment to naturalism. It is not, and you know what naturalism is. That means that you must come up with a natural explanation as to why things are. You must come up with physical processes, no spiritual processes, no supernatural processes. You have to be able to come up with a natural explanation as to why things are. And he says they have a commitment to that. And it is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori, that means our previous adherence to material causes, to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, there it is right there. Anything but God. Let's come up with anything. But in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Because a lot of these guys, they've invested their lives and their careers at pursuing and promoting the ideas of Darwinian evolution. And they're not going to allow anything, especially the idea of a divine creator, to get in the way of them pursuing their agenda. And besides their professional careers and reputations, I mean, there are other reasons that would appeal to an atheist view of no God. Because with God out of the picture, well, a person can behave however he wants, without any feeling that he will ultimately be accountable for his actions and for his choices. I mean, the Apostle Peter in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 5. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 5, he talks about those who would scoff at or deny God's existence. Concerning these atheistic thinkers, Peter wrote, "For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old." And so, you know, Dawkins, you know, he refuses to accept that God spoke the heavens and the earth into existence. But if that's the case, how does he think it all got started? Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Expelled, but there's an interesting interview that takes place between Ben Stein, who was behind the movie, and he actually has a couple of discourses with Richard Dawkins. And I was kind of interested in what Dawkins would say about, because Ben Stein just asked, okay, well, then how? Let me just read an excerpt from the movie for you. Ben Stein asked Richard Dawkins, how did it get created? And Dawkins says, well, by a very slow process. Well, how did it start? Dawkins says, well, nobody knows how it got started. We know the kind of event it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life. And so Stein asked him, and what was that? He answers, it was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule. Stein says, right. And how did that happen? I told you, we don't know. So you have no idea how it got started? No, nobody does. Well, what do you think is the possibility that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in Darwinian evolution? Then he makes this statement. Well, it could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved, probably by some kind of Darwinian means, probably to a very high level of technology, and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. He says, now that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that. If you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer. Now, he's a biologist, and he has to admit, you got a lot of information in the biological world, and that information is arranged in such a way that it sure seems like intelligence is behind it. And so what's his answer to all of this apparent intelligent design? And he says, you know, that a designer could well be a higher intelligence from somewhere else in the universe. And so Ben Stein says, well, so the God of the Bible doesn't exist? And Dawkins' answer is, well, certainly that would be a very unpleasant prospect. So, there you have it. He believes that the origin of life can't be the God that we read about in the Bible, because his existence would be, at least to Richard Dawkins, a very unpleasant prospect. So his solution to the evidence of the intelligent design that he admits can be found in the details of biochemistry and molecular biology. The solution that he offers to Ben Stein is that aliens are responsible. That's exactly what he's saying there. That an intelligent life that had to evolve themselves somewhere earlier in the history of the universe, that they came and they seeded our planet with life. Aliens did it. Is that the best that those who are in the forefront of this battle can say? In this past school year, I've been using one Sunday night every month to present a series of lessons that deal with the lie that we're a result of random mutations and evolutionary trends, or even that aliens seeded this planet with life. I've been using actually the textbooks that our junior high and our high school and our university students are using to show how Darwin's theory of evolution just is not even scientific. It's not science. And in fact, if you go to the actual science periodicals and science journals, you see a lot of things that the scientists will admit in their peer-reviewed articles that they will never say in a textbook or in a classroom. And they admit that there is really no evidence. Professor Wolfgang Smith, he received his PhD in mathematics from Columbia University. He has faculty positions, or held faculty positions, at Massachusetts Institutes of Technology and UCLA. He writes, "I am convinced, moreover, that Darwinism, in whatever form, is not in fact a scientific theory, but a pseudo-metaphysical hypothesis decked out in scientific garb." And then Nobel Prize winner and evolutionist Robert Millikan, he comments that the pathetic thing is that we have scientists who are trying to prove evolution, which no scientist can ever prove. Because again, it's philosophy. It's belief. I have no trouble teaching the facts of biology. I have no trouble teaching that this is a leaf, and that the leaf is green because it contains chlorophyll, and their purpose is in chlorophyll to absorb energy from the sun. And it's a fascinating thing, and my students' eyes would glaze over as I was talking about it. But I loved it, and I had no problem teaching the facts. But then to say that this leaf is a result of billions of years of evolutionary processes, that is a belief system. That is not an observable, testable, scientific fact. And so Colin Patterson, he spoke at the American Museum of Natural History. He's author of the book Evolution. He's an authority on cladistics. He's senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History in London, and he edits their journal. And he said some interesting comments in an interview that appeared in a magazine. He says, "For over 20 years, I thought I was working on evolution, but there was not one thing I knew about it. So for the last few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people and groups of people. The question was, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is absolutely true?" I tried that question on a geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar at the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists, and all I got was silence for a long time, and eventually one person said, "Yes, I do know one thing. It ought not be taught in high school." And he says at the conclusion of that, "During the past few years, you have experienced a shift from evolution as knowledge to evolution as faith." You remember the children's tale about the emperor whose tailor made for him a beautiful set of non-existent clothes, and how everybody was afraid to speak up, and everyone was going along with the fantasy that what a beautiful new wardrobe the emperor has. Well, Ken Hugh, he's an evolutionist professor at the Geological Institute in Zurich, Switzerland. He's former president of the International Association of Sedimentologists. He writes, and he alludes to this children's tale. He says, "We have had enough of the Darwinian fallacy. It's about time we cry, the emperor has no clothes." Now, our children need to know these kinds of things. We need to know these kinds of things. Don't believe the lies of the serpent. But we must go on. He's also referred to as the devil. The primary meaning of the term translated as devil is false accuser or slanderer. He's called this because of his hateful spirit toward the people of God. He's always suspecting evil of them and charging them with evil motives. Isn't that what he did with Job? Back in Job chapter 1, when God had pointed out his faithful servant Job, what did Satan say? What did the devil say about that? He says, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to his face." I mean, the devil just couldn't believe that Job actually served God out of a sincere heart. And the devil's still doing the same thing today. He slanders the children of God. And if you're a Christian, the devil tries to convince you or convince others that there's got to be an ulterior motive to what's going on here. Surely you're not serving him out of the goodness of your heart or out of a genuine love or faith or trust in him. And through slander and through false accusations, he tries to discourage us. He tries to cause us to give up the race. You know, Satan is the one who is behind those who, when he says, "Well, why keep going to church? I mean, those Christians there, they're just a bunch of self-righteous hypocrites." The devil whispers in the young person's ear, "Your parents really don't care about you and what's important in your life, so why listen to them?" The devil tries to tell us in our struggles, "Look at the sin in your life. I mean, you're not even worthy to call yourself a Christian." Well, you just keep in mind that while the devil is trying to discourage, God is your number one fan. He is for you, and he will do whatever he can to encourage you and help you. When the devil is whispering lies in our ears, and maybe we begin to doubt. Remember what John wrote in 1 John chapter 3. We referred to verse 18 last night where he says, "My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And by this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him." But you know, if you've looked in the mirror, but sometimes you're not what you need to be. Sometimes you're not loving in deed and in truth. Sometimes your heart starts listening to those lies that you're not worthy. But look at the next verse. What does John say in verse 20? "For if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our hearts. And he knows all things. He knows if you're trying. He knows what it's like to be discouraged. He knows what it's like when you're down. And aren't you glad that your heart and your feelings at the moment aren't what God uses on the final day? God's greater than your heart, and he knows all things." So don't listen to the false accusations and slander of the devil. And then the fourth and last name by which the evil one is designated is that of Satan. And really the name means adversary or enemy. Brethren, he is our greatest enemy. He is the adversary of every human soul. If he could, he would destroy every one of us. Never underestimate how much he hates you. And that's why Peter warns us in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world." So who is our adversary? He's the dragon. He's powerful. Entire governments can be brought under his control. He is the serpent. He is cunning in the lies and the deceptions that he spread. He's the devil. He accuses and slanders. He speaks evil of anyone that tries to serve God. He is Satan. He is the adversary. He hates you. He is your greatest enemy. Now, let's go back to the text in Revelation 12. Revelation 12. Look at the vision again. Now, the woman has given birth to the child. The dragon was not successful in destroying the child. The child was caught up into heaven. The dragon went up to heaven to try to destroy him up there. He couldn't win. He was cast back down. And so, in beginning in verse 9, let's start back up in verse 9. Revelation 12, verse 9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. The accuser has been cast down. Those who lost their lives because of him are now described as the ones who are victorious. They've overcome him by the blood of the Lamb and their faithful lives in the heavens. And those who are living there in the heavens, they're told to rejoice. But look at the warning, though. Look at the warning that's given with the second sentence there in verse 12. It says, woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. He's angry. His plans are not working out. And so, verse 13, when he saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And so he said, I can't destroy the child. I'm going to turn on the woman that brought the child into being. But what happens to her in verse 14? But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time. That's 3.5 again. And from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And so he tried to destroy the child, couldn't eat it when it first was delivered. Then it was caught up into heaven. He went up after him, but he was cast down out of heaven. He turns on the woman and tries to destroy her, but creation is helping her. She sprouts wings. She begins to fly away. He spews out a river to try to drown her. The earth opens up, and he can't do that. He's not happy. So who can he turn to now? Look at verse 17. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring. Who's that? Who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Folks, that's you and me. Now, how would you like to face an enemy like that alone? The good news is, you don't have to. And really, the message of Revelation is that God and His forces are more than capable to handle Him. And that God's side wins. That's the message of Revelation. That if you're with God and His side, you win. You're victorious. You're one of God's children. You have Jesus on your side. Remember that Revelation was written to give those first century Christians the hope that everything's going to be okay. That something's going to happen to their adversary, who they thought initially was Rome, but now they see, no, there's someone behind the Roman persecution. And the message of Revelation is, he loses. In Revelation chapter 20, and in verse 10, we read that the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. You want to be a part of on the winning side. You want to be a part of that. And you can be. You can be. As we sang earlier, the battle belongs to the Lord. He's the one that is capable of helping you defeat our greatest adversary. So this evening, if you're not yet a child of God, we want to give you the opportunity to do what Jesus said. If you have faith and trust in Him, He says in Mark chapter 16, verse 16, that he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Jesus went through a death, a burial, and a resurrection for you and me. And we're invited to share in that. When Paul in Romans chapter 6 describes, we crucify the old man of sin, we can bury him in the waters of baptism and be resurrected a new creature in Christ. And if you do that, God adds you to His family. God will be on your side. You will be on His side. And you will be on our side. One of the purposes of the family of God is so that we can help one another at times of discouragement, at times when the devil is especially attacking one of us. We're there to rally to their side and help them through those difficult times. We want you to be a part of that family. And if you are a brother or sister and you need our prayers and encouragement, whatever it is, won't you let us know while we stand and while we